Okay, welcome back. Hour number three on this Christmas Eve. Mitchell Henderson is with us tonight. And as we approach the end of the year, we have many unanswered questions. Lots remain to be revealed to us. We just don't know. We're guessing to the best of our ability, projecting, trying to come up with logical and consequential ideas about what is in store for us. We don't know exactly, but we're getting more signs all the time. We're watching the Trump regime. We're watching what's going on in the Middle East. We're watching the simple fact that Trump is a Zionist war president. There's no other way to phrase it. Sorry, it's the truth. So you pro-Trumpers, just understand that's the baggage you're carrying. He is a Zionist-controlled, pro-war president. He's going to give all the money that Israel could ever want to Israel, all the money he thinks or his advisors think that Ukraine will need. He's going to demand that NATO up their annual amount that they give to Ukraine to 5% of their GDP, each country, gross domestic product. So that's how he's going to try to rationalize it. But he's not going to back away from war because he's controlled by the very people creating the wars. All right? That's just a fact. So we're going to see a lot very soon. And Mitchell, welcome back. Merry Christmas to you. Thanks for being here tonight. And tell us what you got.
Merry Christmas to you also.
Yeah. Indeed, thank you.
Well, I was going to talk about organizing for survival. This is the thing is that in my book, The Final War is How to Survive the Coming Civil War in America, World War III, and the Collapse of Civilization. It's basically written for the individual to survive. Okay, because we can't control what other people think and what other people think is happening. Okay.
Yep.
So, but I did want to cover organizing for survival because there's a benefit to having other people with you. One of the biggest benefits is you're in order to build a fire, to cook food, to sleep in a warm place, you really need a group of people because you need to post guards. Okay. You can't all just, party down, pass out at the campsite.
Nope.
And that's it, because people will come in and take everything from you, including your life, okay?
Exactly.
So what's coming is extremely nasty. So it's a benefit. So I wanted to talk a little bit about organizing for survival, and this is in the book, which is available at Amazon. Either type in The Final Wars or Mitchell Henderson. It'll come up under one of the two. So the best people that you could get together for a survival group is family and longtime friends. This is because you are likely to know them well. Some families have a strong blood allegiance and some don't. Throughout life, you've already stress-tested them. But let's be realistic. Family members and longtime friends will always put their own or their immediate family members' interests first.
It's
this is
true.
Natural. Yeah. We are an individualist nation. Your family and friends will turn you into the police if you commit a crime. They will tell all they know about you to help the prosecutor get a conviction. If the Antichrist was in control, your family and friends will turn you into the Antichrist for execution. Okay? What makes them natural allies in the case of total economic collapse with crime and anarchy ruling? Well, what makes them natural allies in the case of Civil War and World War II? The very fact that the threat is not just upon one individual, but on all individuals equally. They may not be loyal to you when they can keep their comfortable lifestyle by betraying you, but when they are under the equal threat, the loyal is likely to be solid. Okay?
Right. Right.
So.
Good point.
So keep that in mind. All right?
Yeah.
So let me explain the dynamics of team loyalty from experience. In the Army, I belonged to a squad of 10 men. Most of these were draftees, so they saw both the enemy as an enemy and the U.S. Army as the enemy also. What we had in common is that we were under the same exact threat, both from the Army itself and from the enemy. It was clear that both administrative and combat survival depended upon complete and unwavering loyalty. As long as each squad member had all the other squad members' back, we were going to stand the best chance of survival. I remember there was a guy on my squad that I just naturally despised. I did not like him or anything about him. The feeling was mutual. He hated me. Huh. We just totally rubbed each other the wrong way. But if this man got into trouble, I would swear to any lie to get him out of trouble. He would do the same for me, and I never doubted that he would. I know this because in over a year, I got him out of much trouble, and he did the same for me. We may not have liked each other, but we definitely respected each other. It was the same in dangerous situations. I knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that he would give up his life to protect me, and I would give up mine to protect him. That is what makes a squad a powerful combat instrument. Loyalty is the symbiotic force. We were united in the common cause of surviving both the Army and the enemy. Although I have not spoken to him in 50 years, I still would never speak ill of him and would still say only good things about him because I still have his back to this day. That is why I have not said his name. Loyalty is a beautiful thing. Okay. When I became a police officer, it was similar. However, loyalty is not as intense. You have that loyalty when confronting criminals most of the time, but not always. Some guys will have your back in a fight, and some won't. Most will not have your back in administrative situations. They will put their career first. Most cops do not see their administrators as enemies. A few cops know they are enemies, okay? The police are different from the military in this respect. A policeman is a soldier that acts alone, and a soldier is a policeman who acts as a part of a team. The dynamic is different. How could I tell who would put their life on the line for me? Ultimately, you had to wait until the bad happened before you could figure that out. Once I got into a major fight with a group of biker types on the beach, my partner was a tall, muscular, handsome college graduate who was smart and witty. I thought he would be a good backup. I pulled my gun on these 12 guys, and he started to back away. The guys picked up logs and tire irons and came towards us. I told them that I would shoot. At that point, my partner ran. The biker guys.
He actually ran? He ran away.
Yes, he ran away.
Oh, you must have been disgusted.
The biker guys kept coming. I smiled and told them that this was a great opportunity to rack up some notches on my gun. They said that I had only 9 bullets, but there was a dozen of them. I said I would be happy to kill 9 of them, starting with the guy with the big mouth. It was a clear draw. My partner running emboldened the crowd. I was not likely to get them to submit to arrest. I told them if they keep coming, at least 9 would die. But I gave them the option to leave the beach. They knew that backup was probably on the way, so they decided that not going to jail was the better option. They were drunk and stoned, but could still reason. About the time they got to their cars, the backup arrived and arrested them all for resisting arrest with violence, a felony in Florida. What was loyalty on my part? I did not tell my supervisors that my partner ran. I took the heat for starting the riot on the beach. My partner's career was more important to him than mine was to me. So,
that's a remarkable story, Mitchell. Wow. See,
they've been there, done that, you know?
Yeah. Mitchell, the stuff you are made of is not all that common anymore. It just isn't. I'm sorry. I don't see it. I don't care what profession you're talking about. The idea of standing behind a partner, right? A member of the team.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there anymore. It's not like it used to be. Those ethics died after World War II, and all the World War II veterans died. It just went away.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think there's very many cops will tell at each other. I mean, listen, when I was a cop, you would never arrest another cop for DWI. And now you have to arrest every cop you get. Okay, so it's like the bosses, the supervisors, the management, okay? They want to control the police as much as they can control the public. And they're not interested in protecting the public. They're interested in controlling you. Okay. So one night in Vice, me and my partner, Randy Keyes, picked up a hooker and made a case on her. She said that we could rent a room at Henry Wilson's house. This was an abandoned house on South Nebraska Avenue that would be considered the worst place you could possibly go. It was a haven for pimps and pushers, and many people met the end of their lives there. The hooker said we could rent a room for $5. Well, we were vice officers, and renting a room for the purpose of prostitution was a crime. It was our job to make that case. We went in and knocked on the door on the first floor downstairs. Randy was standing behind the hooker and looking in the door. I was off to his right. He motioned for me to look in the door. The room was full of junkies shooting up and having a party. Randy flipped his hand in a badge motion and pointed inside behind the hooker's back, as if to ask me if we should bust them. I shook my head and made a gun hand gesture. Some people will respect the badge, but most people will respect the gun. We pushed the hooker through the door and with our guns drawn. I acted out of control, saying, "Freeze, if you as much as blink, there will be chunks of meat flying across the room." This was important, especially in a rundown black neighborhood. They are not afraid of calm and collected police, but they are terrified of insane and out-of-control white police. They froze with the needle still stuck in their raised hands. I did not have to coordinate with Randy. He just knew instinctively what to do. We gained control of the crowd. Randy called for backup because we would need at least 5 cruisers to transport. If Randy did not have my back, that would likely have been my last moments on Earth. We got an immense amount of heroin, cocaine, and crack. We also busted the guy who answered the door for renting room for prostitution. Randy was a warrior. He responded instinctively to control the bad guys. Randy is not big, not muscular, not handsome, was not college educated at the time, but he had absolute courage. He did not look the part. He was the part. He was the real deal. My point is that you cannot tell what a courageous person looks like. Hollywood has us accustomed to the tall, muscular, handsome, well-educated guy being the guy of courage. This is misleading. They also show brave soldiers and special forces guys as buff, handsome, big guys. In the 1990s, I attended a seamanship school to learn how to sail. It was a 4-month course. Midway through, they had a Navy SEAL team come through for an abbreviated course. I was surprised that the Navy had to send SEALs here to learn how to sail boats, drive small power boats, and navigate, but they did. And this is the best school in the country to learn that, too. So the SEALs were nothing like the Hollywood version. They were medium-sized guys, almost scrawny, and sort of just regular people. We thought they would act like the elite people they were, but they were very down-to-earth individuals. They were humble and likable guys. When we went drinking, I thought the SEALs would be the wild guys that would get into fights. It was the civilian students that got into the fights. The SEALs have top-secret clearances. They must behave to keep their jobs. Most of the other students were veterans, so conversations were easy. And talking to them, they stressed that what got them through training was endurance, not brute strength. The key to qualifying was to never quit. My point is that real SEALs do not look like the Hollywood version of SEALs, nor do they act like them. I have never met a special operator that I could not get along with. But this is, back like 20, 30 years ago. Okay? So, in all my military training, it was the same. All you really had to do was not quit, and you would be there on graduation day. I did fail helicopter flight school, but that was not me quitting. That was me crashing 2 helicopters in a row. It was just too expensive for the Army to chance me crashing some more. I did not quit. I was kicked out, but they were not mad at me. They liked me. They just did not want to be in a helicopter with me at the controls.
They had to make a practical decision. I got it.
Right. Yeah. So, anyways, And they asked me why I didn't just go to officer school, because this program for warrant officers was 44 weeks long, and it was only 12 weeks long to become a commissioned officer. And if you get to the flight school, you become a warrant officer that gets paid less than a commissioned officer. So I ended up just going to officer candidate school. And officer candidate school was very easy for me because I'd already been to 7 months of this other school. So what kind of person will be good in a survival situation? That is a very hard question. Throughout life, you have stress tested your family and close longtime friends. You have figured out who your fair weather friends are and let them go. I stress tested my neighbors and find most of them wanting. When the shit hits the fan, only about 7 out of 65 neighbors will possibly have my back. It is better to find this out now before the trouble begins.
Oh, you bet.
Because if there's trouble now, there'll be more trouble after the shit hits the fan.
Right.
So sometimes to avoid, your civic-minded asset to the community is usually a horrible person, as are all community leader types. Elected officials at any level are infected with an entitlement to rule mind virus. They are by far the most terrible people I've met in my life. Survival leadership is not a popularity contest. A military leader is someone who can put everyone under him first. The word sergeant means servant. If your sergeant thinks that the people under him are his servants, he is not a leader. In the old German army, a sergeant was called a Feldwebel, or a field wife. The leader is responsible for everything and everyone. I cannot impress upon you enough what kind of person your leaders need to be. A leader in a war or survival is your servant, not your boss. A boss will get you killed. Zelensky in Ukraine is a boss. He has gotten over 600,000 of his people killed, probably closer to a million. Putin is a leader. He puts troops' lives first. A leader will and should delegate authority, but never responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Failure is always the leader's fault. A leader who blames his men is not a leader. Keep in mind things like what happened in Afghanistan, okay? These people that lead our military are not leaders. They do not take accountability. They do not take responsibility for
anything. They're grifters,
many
of them. It's disgusting. I've heard horrible stories.
They're disgusting human beings.
Yeah.
So,
now, there are some good
sense.
Ones, but we got to mention that. There certainly are exceptions, but there's too much opportunity.
I think in the current military, there might be, if there's 44 generals, there's probably 4 of them that are leaders.
Wow.
I've met one-star general who's a leader right now. He's mm-hmm. active now. One-star general who is a leader. And uh-huh. I met a two-star general that's a leader. And those are the only two I've met.
You can't imagine these people out leading their troops. There's no way. They're bureaucrats. They're desk jockeys.
They are bureaucrats, political bureaucrats at that, okay? So it makes sense that in your group you may have many veterans. This includes former soldiers, sergeants, and officers. Your leaders should be infantry, cavalry, or combat engineers, okay? Because these are fighting jobs, okay? These are people who fought. I mean, listen, anybody who's been in the military at all is an asset to you because they understand how the military works. But ideally, you want people who were grunts, who were in the infantry, cavalry, or combat engineers, okay? So anybody who is like airborne infantry, air mobile, rangers, special forces, marines, marine recon, Navy SEALs, these are all light infantry, and they know what they're doing, okay? Many veterans, and I mean many, inflate their service records. I often sat in the VA waiting room talking to federal veterans, only to find out, day after day and time after time, that I was the only guy who served in the military that was not in special forces.
The only one.
anyone. Wow. It's like everybody else, whether they're in the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, they were all in Special Forces. And I'm the only one sitting there that wasn't.
Okay.
So it's not just Stolen Valor civilians that inflate the records. Veterans do it also. Be careful. Beware of the chair-borne Rangers. 9 out of 10 veterans who said they were Special Forces were not. There is nothing wrong with an Army or Marine grunt. They have a tough job. Okay.
All right. Hey, I have a question.
Yes.
We have a lot of people out there, and some of them have tried to make plans and preparations. Mm-hmm. They might have 10, 20 acres maybe somewhere. And there's just a couple of them, maybe just a married couple. Maybe their children are grown and gone. And they want to bring somebody out to their... I've heard this before. They want to bring somebody out to the property in exchange for rent to help set up some kind of a, even a one-man or a one-woman perimeter, some kind of defensive perimeter for them. They want somebody there who knows how to handle firearms and knows the game. How do they go about... Now, there are a lot of veterans out there that would fit that bill. How would they go about finding somebody like that?
Well,
They wouldn't advertise, military veteran wanted for security service on 20 acres. Would they... Is that... What would I tell these people?
Well, I think the best thing they can do is... you're going to have to find it from people that you know, okay? Because let me give you an example that a good example of this, okay? So I had this girlfriend, and she would house sit for this very, very wealthy family, okay? Now now this, most wealthy families, I'm not usually too impressed with the people, but these people were actually kind of kind and considerate people. Okay,
right.
I actually liked them. They were good people. My girlfriend was a very good person. Okay, but she house sat for them, and they lived in this gated community with lots of security and stuff, and it was a big, fabulous house. So one day she asked me to bring something by for her because she couldn't leave. Okay, and So I drove up, and I drove to the gate, and she said, "I'll call down to the gate and tell them who you are, and they'll let you in." Okay. So while I was waiting at the gate, talking to security and stuff, they're opening the gate and stuff, I just engaged them in communication and some conversation, and I said, "Well, what if the shit hit the fan? Are you going to come and report for your job?" And they said, "Oh, well." Yeah, we're going to show up here, but we're not going to be protecting these people. Our family will be living in their house. So this is the problem with hiring people. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they might decide to take...
I didn't know what to tell these people who asked me. This is a couple of years ago. I didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
How do you know? How do you know what somebody is really all about? Who are they really? What are their values?
See,
this is why
if you're going to have somebody do this, it's better to network to friends and family and find friends or family members
who can do this because these people
will have a little bit of loyalty towards you, at least. Okay, a total stranger is not. Total strangers are going to be the bane of your existence when the shit hits the fan.
Well, that's why I told them. I said, I can't help you.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're right. You've got to go through friends and family, people at work you trust and respect. Do you know anybody who was in the military who might be interested in some security work? That's what you're saying, and you're right. Totally. You've got to have some way to get a handle on some.
And look at their, not only that, but if they were in the military, you're more likely to know what they did. It's like, say, the support people, there's 7 support people for each combat person and stuff, and really what you need at this level is you need somebody who was in combat arms, okay, that had this drilled into them how to fight stuff, okay, so that would include basically your big fighting people, or your infantry, your cavalry, your armor, your combat engineers, some combat arms. It's called combat arms. You can look it up on the internet and see what combat arms are. And then if it's somebody that had one of those jobs, you know, that's the better people. They've been out in the field. They've been at least practicing this. If they haven't been to war, they've at least practiced it. And that's better than nothing.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
So let me just tell you another interesting conversation I had. This was with a real Q person. Okay.
Yeah.
This is kind of different because he told me that the QAnon thing was a little bit different than what's portrayed and what people commonly think. He said the Q movement. He called it the Q movement. The Q movement. You see, if you're a civilian and you do top secret work, you get a Q clearance. If you're in the military, you get a top secret clearance. But civilians get a Q clearance. So they built these big underground bunkers and they have to maintain them and they have to stock them and stuff for the 0.05% to go to. Currently, FEMA's telling you, yeah, just get in a big building somewhere, you know, whatever. These people don't care about you. They're just shining you on, okay? The people who built these bunkers and maintain these bunkers and even do security for these bunkers have to have a Q clearance. So just like the guys at the security gate, these Q clearance people that had to do this, they realized they're building this for people to survive. These people that they're building it for wouldn't give them the time of the day and don't care about them at all. And they realized that their families doesn't get to move into these bunkers. So the Q movement was the people involved in building these things, they're going to go take it over and move their family and friends in and get rid of the government officials that are trying to hide out there. So that's what the true Q movement is what this person told me, okay? And he was a construction contractor that had done work for the government. So you can take that or leave it. But I, you know, in view of what the security guards told me at the gated community, I think it's very, very likely. Okay. You know, I was working in the emergency room here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is 10, 15 years ago. And I was approached by this group of firemen, policemen that were trying to recruit doctors and nurses and, you know, other paramedics and EMTs and stuff. What they did is there was an area of town, and they were encouraging everybody that had these jobs to move into that area of town so that if the shit hits the fan, they have a community of specialists and experts. Okay, so I was approached on this, but the point of this is how many other towns and cities across America do they have police and, you know, firemen and stuff that are creating their own havens and stuff that are preparing for this? This was 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you have to figure that there's people out there that are getting prepared that keep it to themselves. Okay.
Gotcha.
So I generally respect any man who served in the military in any capacity. Some of the people that I appreciated very much when I served were the supply sergeants that got me the equipment supplies that I needed, the finance specialists that got me paid, the medic that fixed me up, the combat engineers that put up a bridge for me or dug a hide position for my tank, the mechanic that got me going, the truck driver that saved me a 20-mile forced march, the artilleryman who laid down preparatory fires for me, the airmen that gave me air support, and the list goes on. I value all these people. Combat arms people specifically know how to fight. It is the stock and trade of the infantry. The cavalry is just infantry on steroids. They tend to be more skilled because they are scouts, and one of their duties is to attack oncoming enemy forces to force them to deploy before they want to. In the Army, they allow cavalrymen to wear a Stetson hat with cross sabers, big brass U.S. buckles and spurs on their boots in recognition of the risks that they must take in combat. Do not let Hollywood dictate to you who is cool. I have nothing but respect for the straight-legged infantryman, and you should too. The infantryman is what the military is about. They call them grunts because they can take it. Infantry is the tip of the spear. The Navy exists to get supplies to the infantrymen on the front. The Marines exist to secure the beachhead so that the infantrymen can land and go on the attack. The Air Force exists to get the infantryman where he's going and to give him air support in his engagements with the enemy. Everyone else in the Army exists to support the infantrymen on the front. Obviously, your survival group will operate as infantry, but without all that awesome support. You cannot do what an infantry unit does because you simply will not have the logistics to do so. You must conserve supplies of ammunition. Battles spend supplies at a very high rate. After even a short but intense firefight, there is an overwhelming amount of spent brass scattered about. You want to always avoid battles because it is too expensive. You may have to do battle to destroy a group that will not leave you alone, but you must do a cost-benefit analysis first because it will cost you dearly. If you have a leader that wants to go on a campaign of conquest, you need to fire him. He is going to get you killed for his own selfish reasons.
Yeah,
your job, what you're trying to do is survive, not to conquer, not to overthrow anything. You're just trying to live. That is the most cost-efficient thing that you can do. Beware of impulsive, paranoid, narcissistic people. If a leader emerges who acts like a boss, you need to fire him before he gets you killed. The point to survival is to survive, not to be burdened by people who will complicate your life. You also want team players, people who will execute orders without argument. This is what great soldiers and policemen do. They execute the mission or plan. No quibbling and no conscience. Just do what must be done. Okay? That is very critical. Anybody who's been in law enforcement and has been in the military will know that execute thing is very important. Just do it. Okay. Do not hesitate. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about organization a little bit. Okay. So I'm gonna break this down into like teams, squads, and so forth. I'm gonna discuss a little bit about how to build these teams and stuff. And this is not what the military does. Okay. This is just sort of common sense, okay? So a team is five men. So we will start with one man. If you are by yourself, you will be a sniper. You need to always put as much distance between you and your enemy as possible to stay alive. You cannot afford to be involved in close quarters combat. It is simply too risky. You are not Rambo. You are Lee Harvey Oswald, okay? You need to eliminate your enemies at a distance. You need to hit and run. There will be no big standoffs for you because you will lose such an engagement.
You know, Mitch, I was just thinking about the media, the movies, TV.
Yes.
How many images have they put into people's subconscious minds that have nothing to do with reality about this very subject? Nothing. They have no idea. It's all about Rambo. They think or Marvel Comics. They think they're just going to blow away the opposition, kill the bad guys. No, it doesn't work that way. People are just woefully unprepared for dealing with what's coming. That's why your book is so incredibly important. People, if they want to have a chance, they'll get your book. Otherwise, they're not. If they look at TV, they're gone. I'm not going to make it.
Oh, yeah. Well, compare the Rambo story with... Look up the story of an Army Special Forces guy in Vietnam named Ray Benavides. Okay? This man was Rambo. If you want to see what it takes to be Rambo, read what this man did. Read his Medal of Honor citation. Okay? They thought he was dead. I think he had an ungodly amount of bullet wounds and stuff. What's the odds that you're going to survive that? I mean, he just he had a lot of luck on his side. Okay, but
yeah.
But if you read what he did to get his Medal of Honor, you would be like, you know what? I really don't want to go through that. It hurts.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you know, but the time you become Rambo is when you have no choice, when there's nothing, when you're surrounded and they're going to take you out. You know, you have to go on the attack. When the situation is hopeless, attack. Okay, you might actually make it through, but probably not. But you might as well attack and, you know, do your fellow human beings a favor by getting rid of as many of them as you can. Okay,
right.
So
I understand.
Okay,
you know, I have
if you're one person. Oh, go ahead.
Right.
Go ahead.
I have another question. It's off topic here, but I'm not sure it is. I've mentioned a few times they have compilations, video compilations of auto crashes as recorded by dash cams. All right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are in trucks. Big trucks have them. Tractors have them. Anyway,
yeah.
There are also some videos showing police chases. All right? And
right.
They're chasing somebody, runs, and they're doing 55 or 60 and a 30 and they, whatever. And the mm-hmm. police have the front of their cars have the two vertical bars. They're very strong in the front of the car. It looks like you know, for pushing vehicles out of the way, which is exactly what
right.
they're for. And they'll come up next to somebody who's trying to get away or approach them from behind, and they'll take their police cruiser and cause that car, they'll hit it in the back, usually left rear, right rear, and they'll cause it to flip, roll, and be destroyed, maybe killing the occupants. And they're mm-hmm. doing that under the guise, I guess, of keeping other people safe. But it looks to me like some of these people are obviously needing psychological, they need help. They're messed up in the head. That's why they're running. All right, they're
mm-hmm.
speeding, cops come up, I think they call it, what do they call it, a pick? They call it something like that.
Pit stop, yeah.
Pit. And they push the car sideways so it flips over, runs off the road, possibly into the oncoming lanes, you never know. It's very uh-huh. dangerous. And my point is, why don't they just let some of these guys run? They're not going to get away. There are helicopters and other police officers all over the place. Why take a chance on rolling a car at 60, 70 miles an hour, which not only may kill innocent people in the car, passengers, as well as the driver, but it may kill other people, innocent bystanders. Is this a smart thing to do, this pit attack on a runaway car or a car that's evading arrest?
Well, it depends on where you are. Obviously, you don't want to do that when there's a lot of traffic.
It's a hell of a judgment call, but I've seen some videos of these things that they're done on busy roads. It's crazy. I just don't get it. Another thing that I've seen police do, let's say they run a pit operation or get a car to spin out, roll over, and nobody's coming out of it. So every cop there has his or her gun, their service weapon drawn. Some of them have an AR or a shotgun. And they got 10 guns on this car that's just been rolled over and destroyed as it tried to evade police. They don't know what's in there. I guess they're doing it to protect themselves, but it looks to me like an awful lot of firepower is being directed at a car that's just been knocked over and rolled by a pit operation. So that's another thing I'm wondering about. They pull their guns awfully fast.
You've got to worry about that person coming out shooting. Let me tell you, when I would pull people over when I was a cop and stuff, just a regular traffic stop.
Yeah.
You don't know what's in the car. There's many times
I understand that. I get that. That's the reason. I get
into
it.
Into hell.
But still.
But, you know, I would approach the car. I usually would have my gun out, hidden by my clipboard. So my clipboard and gun would be in the same hand. And
these guns are all out, and they're all pointed right at the vehicle. Anything
right,
that moves is
lift,
in trouble.
They lifted a gun towards me, I have the drop on. There was a border patrolman named, what was his name? Bill Jordan. He was known as the fastest draw, the best shot in the Border Patrol. Actually, just the best shot, period. And fastest draw, period. He worked with my dad in the Border Patrol, and he told my dad that the fastest draw is a gun already pulled out and pointed at the person. Okay, mm-hmm. That's the fastest draw you can get. So you always want to have that advantage. It's all about little advantages and stuff. Okay?
I've seen up to 15 officers with their weapons drawn approaching a car that has just rolled five or six times.
You don't know. I get the rationale. I know officers that were killed during chases. You know, officers that were killed in traffic stops and stuff. I know officers that were standing alongside the road with a broken down car, and they got deadlined. Somebody just ran them over. Okay, not on purpose, but they were drunk and they hit him and killed him.
Or they're on their phones. That too.
Yeah, it's very dangerous out there. So, it's better to be safe than sorry.
They're certainly being safe. All right, very good.
Right. So if you add another person, he will become the primary sniper, and you will be the spotter or shot caller. You both need main battle rifles with some optics. A high-powered bolt-action rifle will do. A third person will be the rear guard. He should have an assault-type rifle like an AR-15 or AK-47 because he is watching your back while you are concentrating on the enemy to the front.
When you say optics, are we talking about red dot, that kind of thing?
Well, the guy with the assault rifle should have a red dot, but the sniper should have a good long range scope.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
So the fourth person will be the flank guard. He will also have an assault type weapon for close combat. He guards the flank while you are shooting and while you are moving. The fifth person will be the point man. He will have a 12-gauge shotgun, either semi-automatic or pump action. He will walk the point, and when he makes contact with the enemy, he can lay down suppressive fire, which gives the rest of the team time to react appropriately. Ideally, the first shell should be a slug so he can hit the first enemy he sees and kill him, followed by double-aught buckshot for suppressive fire. Each double-aught buckshot shell has 9 32-caliber pellets that travel at 1,200 feet per second and hit with the force of 200 foot-pounds of energy. It can kill whoever it hits within 100 feet.
Yeah.
So
now,
quick
question. There are all kinds of different shot sizes. Number 3, number, 5, 7, I don't know. There are a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Like a number 3 is not good enough. Number 4, you need to have 00 buck. Is that what you're saying? Number 3 won't do anything?
Yeah, for combat, you need for people, you need 00 buck. That's the shotgun for people is 00 buck. Okay.
Got it. Any preference between 12 or 20? They have pretty
12,
good.
The
20 has pretty good comparables to the 12, and it doesn't knock you on
your
ass.
Well, you know what I suggest to people, and usually they take this advice, is for the women, I suggest 20 gauges. I have found that women can handle a 20 gauge better than they can handle a 12 gauge.
Yeah.
So that's a good gun for smaller people, children, and women. The 20 gauge is better. Okay.
Gotcha. Okay.
So this makes an infantry team. The spotter will be the team leader. If something happens to the spotter, the sniper will be the team leader. The team should follow the following rank hierarchy. So your point man's a private, your flank guard's a private, your rear guard's a private, your sniper is a corporal, and your spotter is the sergeant. He's the leader. Okay. The cooperation between the five men on a team gives the team synergy in the defense that makes them more powerful than just the five men on their own. Just for an illustration, a well-cooperating team of five men has a combat power of 10 men, okay? So now we'll go to the next level is a squad. The sixth man should be a flank guard, the seventh man a sniper, the eighth man a spotter, the ninth man a rear guard, the 10th man a point man, the 11th man a squad leader. He must be a good leader who puts his men first, who has attention to detail, who is tactically and technically efficient. Okay, the squad leader is a staff sergeant. Once you have a full squad, you have greater capability. You now have two fire teams, which is the minimum for a fight. The squad can attack positions. One team will be the fire team that keeps suppressive fire on the enemy position, while the other team, the maneuver team, flanks the enemy position. This requires careful coordination because the fire team needs to keep suppressive fire up while the maneuver team falls upon the enemy flank. As the maneuver team runs across the enemy positions, killing all the enemy fighters, the fire team will shift fire away from the oncoming troops so they don't kill their own men. The squad leader will remain with the fire team to coordinate the battle. It's more important to coordinate the fire support so that you don't kill your own people. Once again, your objective is survival, so you will want to avoid combat. But if you have to get into a fight, you will have more combat power with the squad. The cooperation between the two teams is synergistic. It gives them the combat power of many more men. A squad is the basic unit for a hasty attack, if absolutely necessary, and the basic unit for patrolling. Okay, the next thing will be a section, 25 men. Once you have built a second squad, you have more combat power and have the ability to conduct basic raids and ambushes. The section leader should be a sergeant first class, and then you should add at least two, since you got two sections, two squads in this section. You need two messengers, your signalmen, and you should give them the rank of corporal so that, you know, they have a little bit of that status, you know. I would suggest that he has two signalsmen to be messengers to coordinate activity between the squads. They can use radios or be foot messengers. They should be skilled at many different methods of signaling so that they have backup methods. These signalmen should be corporals. They need to be leaders and have some command presence. People need to take them dead seriously. They also must be very trustworthy men with good memories. Okay. So let me go to the platoon, which will be about 60 men. Once you have two sections, you have enough for a platoon. The platoon is the unit that has sufficient combat power to conduct any combat operations. For survival purposes, the platoon should have logistics sergeant to focus on organizing supplies for survival and operations. He should be aided by two corporals who are good at logistics. It would be good at this level to also have a signals sergeant who can train and coordinate all the messengers. At the platoon level, you should also have two messengers to help coordinate actions between the two sections. Also, if you have a few EMTs or other medically trained people, have at least two medics, one for each section to help with injuries and organizing hygiene. This is much bigger than a regular platoon, but this is likely will be the biggest unit that can be organized. If so, you can create more jobs and bring more talent to the community. In a complete collapse of society, there would be a lot of combat power and security in a platoon. It would discourage most bandits and raiders who will probably have smaller organizations, okay? So the organization of the platoon could be as follows. The platoon leader, a second lieutenant, a platoon sergeant, a master sergeant, signal sergeant, a sergeant, two messengers that are corporals, a supply sergeant that's a sergeant, two supply clerks that are corporals, two medics that are sergeants, then the first section and the second section of 25 men. Okay, so realistically, most groups are not even going to be able to get up to the size of a platoon. Okay?
No,
but let me go ahead
no.
and mention a company.
Yeah. We have to
Once
wrap it up,
two,
Mitch. Mitch, we're out of time here. So it's in the book. Everything you need to know.
It's in the book. It's in the book. And actually, the platoon is the biggest that you're going to probably get. Okay, I can't foresee in these situations of getting a group larger than that together.
Well, that's very good. All right. The Final Wars, just go to Mitchell Henderson under Amazon or the title of the book, And that's the one. That's the Bible. That could mean all the difference right there. All right, my friend, thank you. Merry Christmas, Mitch. And
okay, Merry Christmas to you, and Merry Christmas to all the listeners.
Yes, they appreciate you. All right, you be well. Take good care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye. Okay.
All right, everyone, that's it. Christmas Eve, thank you for being here. Have a wonderful day tomorrow. Have the best day you possibly can. And for all of you who can't have a good day tomorrow for reasons we've talked about many times, don't feel you are completely forgotten. You're not. We care. And try to keep that in mind. Have a Merry Christmas, everyone, and we'll talk to you on Thursday.